Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In this episode of Historians React, I invite HEMA practitioners and historians Yasin Tsouriadis and Elizabeth Champion to dive into the meaning and concept of chivalry. We discuss its origins, how it altered over time, and chivalry's place in modern culture. The episode was recorded 12th July 2021. Welcome everyone to another episode of Historians React, and this month our topic is what is chivalry? Now once again my two guests are my friends Elizabeth Champion and Yasin Tsouriadis, who are both historians as well as historical fencers. So let's start with Elizabeth, if you just introduce yourself to the listeners.
Hi, yeah, I'm Elizabeth. I'm currently completing my master's at the University of Leeds. Focus on the late medieval tournament and Arthurian literature, which is why I'm so excited to be talking about chivalry in this episode. Thank you so much, Fran, for inviting me on again.
It's a pleasure. And Yasin.
Hello, thank you again for inviting us once more. I am Yasin Tsouriadis. I am an early career curator. I research arms and armour. My specialization is usually the perception of edged weapons. I also write on medieval tournaments, propaganda, art, military history, and other subjects. Of course, as well as European martial arts.
Of course.
Yeah, and I'm currently the online editor for the Martial Culture and Medieval Towns Research Project hosted by the University of Bern. Check my Twitter for updates on that if you want to read more.
What's your Twitter handle, Yasin?
It's at YasinZur, T-Z-O-U-R.
T-Z-O-U-R.
Yeah, very unpopular, unfortunately.
Oh, we'll get you some more followers. So I'm very happy to be treading water out of my depth here. So this is something that you two have been dying to sort of get your teeth into. You're using all of the metaphors here. But, you know, I'm not a historian. I genuinely wanted to sort of ask your opinions and your knowledge on this topic, because it's something that's come up again and again, particularly in the historical European martial arts and the reenactment communities and any sort of all of the sword community, really. The topic of chivalry and even in sort of wider society, it comes up again and again. And there's a lot of variations on what chivalry is or was, and our general understanding of it is quite mixed. So I want to just sort of ask you guys and sort of get to the bottom of it. And let's start off by asking you, Elizabeth, what is chivalry and how did it come to be?
Oh, that's a really good question. And you know what? When I listen to podcasts, I hate it when historians go, well, it's a very complicated issue, actually. But it's a very complicated issue, actually. No, chivalry has a lot of it's the best way to explain it would be, well, the way most people know of it is it being sort of a code of conduct for knights to follow, but it's also a knightly class in the feudal times. So particularly in English law, chivalry, you know, meant sort of a tenure of land through a knight's service. So it sort of manifests in a lot of different ways. And regarding how it came to be, do you know, I'm not that sure, because my focus sort of is when it starts to become a bit more popular, there is emphasis on it deriving from the French term for horsemanship, the old French term, chevalier. I can't fully answer that question, because I don't really think there is a time where it goes, we're establishing this. But you do get later some chivalric orders that go, we are establishing this. Maybe Yasin can sort of expand on it a little bit better and more well-worded.
First of all, I just whenever I hear the term feudal, which usually you hear from I don't know, like video gamers, especially in that. But of course, from historians, obviously. But I just remember a professor of mine that she used to say that in my class, you can say fuck as much as you want, but the F word, feudal, is not to be said. I think it is really complicated. I think, yeah, like Elizabeth is spot on with the French terms, like for chevalier and chevalerie. But I think roughly, if something like this can be pinpointed in a time, I think it's roughly in the 12th century, where it's a term to describe, when you start having a more distinct martial elite in the form of the knights, which of course are they are mainly the cavalry of the time, and the horse is an integral part of that. However, of course, the horse is removed from the role, and then is maybe a factor that sometimes we associate with knights and chivalric images. However, later is not as integral as that ethos and all the things that Elizabeth mentioned, you know, the code of conduct. I think it is it's important to early on to immediately make sure for our listeners to establish that chivalry is an artificial construct. It was in its since it came to be, it was something that even in its contemporary use from the 12th, 13th, 14th century is something that is already romanticized. The fact that it exists as an ideal code, it does not mean that people were adhering to it or it was enforced. There was not chivalry police, you know, like, you know, you don't do these things. It's something people simply created as an idea, but I guess we're going to talk about this later. I don't think there's a moment in time where people say, oh, now there's chivalry. There wasn't before, but now there is. I think it comes organically. Probably literary historians are, much like Elizabeth, are way more fitting researching this than myself, to be honest, when that appears first.
Sorry, chap. Someone's got some paper or something, and I can hear it clicking.
Oh, not me, I'm afraid.
Someone's fidgeting with something, and I can't. It's a little bit distracting, but yes. I don't know where it is. Maybe there's a fourth person playing with paper or something, but writing down the chivalric code. So, the chivalric code that often gets quoted, is that utter nonsense then?
No, well, it's not really. I think it's easy for people to go, well, because it couldn't be followed, that therefore it didn't exist. But there were efforts to sort of codify knightly conduct. I'm trying to think, Yasin might know, it was set down maybe 1300s, 1400s, someone starts to write down some tenets for chivalric sort of conduct, as it were. And also you get a lot of it throughout literature as well. Sorry, Yasin, go on.
I think that there's a few writers like Geoffrey de Charny and Ramon.
That's who I was thinking of.
Who writes the famous, principles of chivalry? But there's a few people, there's a few writers throughout the Middle Ages who write like a list of like what did the code of chivalry include. However, again, like all these things are constructs, right? They write these from a romanticized aspect of this. It's not. All these things about being pious and demonstrating largesse and all these different main principles that a knight should have are not necessarily things that these people that belong to that martial elite would follow. I think the idea of the code of conduct as having something like this, it reminds me often of the pirate conduct by Bartholomew Roberts. In the sense that they were both romanticized in the 18th and the 19th centuries as something, you know, oh, these were fixed things. Like, you had like these articles that everybody followed.
As more of a guideline, is that what you're saying?
yeah.
I think there's a distinction to be made here. So, for example, with Sharni's book, it's not really intended as necessarily a like a manual, that, because the nature of the Code of Chivalry is a very conceptual thing. It's not really when this happens, you are to do this as such. Although you do get instances of that, it's more talking that are associated with knights and the qualities you should have as a knight, as opposed to how you can really go about achieving that.
I mean, just to sort of tie it into HEMA briefly,
we
think about fight books. I'm going to say fight books so that Yasin doesn't get angry. when we read the fight books, apart from, you know, being very technical and saying this is how you hold the sword and this is what you do with it, in a lot of the chapters, when particularly at the head of each of the start of a book, like the written in books are usually in several parts, the author, the fencing master, like Lichtenau, for example, they will tend to speak directly to the reader. And they are often sort of telling the young man, it's always a young man, how to be, like how to live and how to conduct yourself. And it's that's what it kind of reminds me of, like, is it Lichtenauer who says young knight learn?
I think in the case of the Zettel in the Germanic tradition, it's more about imitating the tropes of its contemporary literature. You know, at the time we're talking about late 14th 15th century literature at the time, and the subject of chivalry had already been the subject of literature and romances for at least two centuries. It was popular, it was sexy, and it was a sexy medium for transmitting these ideas. You know, like referring to somebody as a knight, does not necessarily mean that it was referring to an actual knight. However, it's not an identifying feature of us today that we pretend to be knights, pirates, and swashbucklers when we were kids. You know, that people have been doing this for centuries. On the other hand, the earlier fight books, you know, like that, like very popular among those people who study in HEMA nowadays, the so-called Lichtenau tradition. Do not let me get started on this, please. It's the way that they were presented. You can tell that before printing, where most of these German fight books belong to. They were actually aimed to a martial elite.
Yes.
Possibly these were knights. These were in some form nobles and so on and so on. In regards to the gender, I think it's also a great question as well. We can discuss it later. Knighthood and gender. And I think you're right that it usually addresses as well men in those texts. However, there are exceptions.
And you were saying, like, you know, by that time, it was already around romanticized, like, so stories about knights and ways of being, etc. This lifestyle, this ideal was already kind of legendary. And a sort of aspirational, like you say, sexy way of being. Let's just talk about the romances. So, Elizabeth, this is your wheelhouse. Let rip.
Yes. Yeah, it's. I think it's important to say that when we talk about romances, we've not sort of. It's a very particular style of writing, and you get a subset of this called the chivalric romance, and it tends to be prose once you hit about the 13th century, and it tends to be part of larger cycles such as, you know, the massive Vulgate cycle. And it's interesting, Sharni's sort of
sorry, Elizabeth, you're cutting out a little bit there.
Oh, sorry, let me slow down a bit. If you take Sharni's Book of Chivalry, his code of conduct for knights, he actually does assign some roles to women, although of course they don't feature very strongly, and he gives them sort of, he says, great feats of art. They very much drive this concept of courtly love,
and Courtly Love was a guest on Paris, and there's a lot of debate as to how we use it, but effectively it means
it's a very kind of noble way of loving, but it can get quite sexy at times as well, because it says things like Capilanus in his 12th century work mentions that he has some rules that say marriage isn't an excuse for loving other people. You're allowed to love others, and so you're starting to get all these sort of contradictory things coming into the chivalric code, and we see that through a lot of literature around 13th, 14th, 15th century even.
So is that the kind of like unrequited love, you know, putting someone on a pedestal and never ever speaking to them, just loving them from afar kind of thing?
Yeah. You have it as Gawain and the Green Knight. Gawain, for instance, really, really to be a good guest and follow this sort of code of conduct, because on the one hand, he's tied to the Lord's
way.
But in a similar way, the lady ties him to some promises that are directly contradictory to how he should act as a knight towards the Lord. And you see this sort of this tension, and you get it also in the prose Merlin, where his manner of fighting to defend his fellow friends actually would go against the code of conduct for chivalry, despite chivalry having this sort of sociological focus and looking after people in combat that derives from sort of the origins of the code, when on the battlefield you start to have openly killing opponents becoming less of a thing, and it's more of a focus on taking prisoners as well. So in literature, you do have these very, very heightened fantastical ways in which chivalry is being achieved by these knights. However, you do have these issues being brought in by the characters of trying to follow the code and actually failing.
So it's kind of, you know, it's drama basically, isn't it?
Very much so, very much so. And I think because of this, it's very, you know, the code of chivalry didn't exist. Oh, it did exist, but that doesn't necessarily mean people were following it. And it was sort of this idea of continually trying to
knight you can be,
but also understanding that that's probably going to be completely unattainable. Most literary characters never achieve this, apart from one or two of the Round Table knights. So it's an interesting sort of tension there.
It was. If I may jump in here. The romanticization of the code of conduct within the chivalric boundaries and the romances that influenced, of course. It was a product of a society that was searching for a literary trope to express the best form, the idealistic form of a certain aspect of it. In that case, the martial elite. But even before these romances that talk about chivalric ideas, the same principles do exist in literature. Even before the 12th century, we do have sources in regards to the militias, the knights, and how they should ideally behave, right? So you have the knights again in the 11th and the 10th centuries that supposedly try to adhere to specific conduct and ideals. And what is interesting is that even at its core, chivalry is often it's always related to religion as well. Mm-hmm. Which of course, if we look at religion from a sociological perspective, it's another sort of set of rules and ways to conduct oneself in society, right? Like that's why that's one of the reasons that religion developed. And it's not surprising that it's incorporated in the other. I do find fascinating how romances, and I'm taking this from a paper that Elizabeth gave last week at the International Medieval Congress. Congratulations for that.
Congrats.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's fascinating to see how the representation of chivalry in a romantic, by romantic I literally context, changes. Right. So you have these. These mythological sort of cycles with the most predominant one being the Arthurian tales. That changed massively because, of course, like Arthurian romance, Arthurian tales are not new in the 12th century. They already exist for a long time. But then they changed to incorporate and facilitate these principles that chivalry sort of dictates in the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries.
And so, you know, there's the romance, both the sort of romantic as in what we understand to be romantic as in romantic tropes of stories. There's romance as in the cycles. There's we touched briefly on the sort of religious aspects of chivalry. So it was, there's piety, isn't there? So it was kind of like knights were kind of forced to follow. I'm guessing this now. You two already shout at me, so no, you're wrong. Shut up, Fran. So to sort of be pious and take part in mass regularly and be kind of, you know, very stringent and adhere to religious practices. Is this all part of trying to sort of, you know, be a better person or live in the ideal way that a knight's supposed to live?
It's a very good question. I think there's a lot of, it's difficult when we try and place religion in sort of the context of chivalry, and most listeners will probably know about sort of the Knights Templar and all these kind of orders that were founded with sort of establishing Christianity in other countries. It's 930 by Odo, who's an abbot, who talks about how, you know, the Christian doctrine can be shown through, he says, unsheathing the sword against the enemy. And he very much champions this idea of like sort of having knights of Christ. So that definitely, so you've got chivalry and you've got sort of pageant-like displays of chivalry as the tournament develops, for instance, and you get a lot of pushback from the church about the tournament, but also it gets to a point where actually the church sort of end up allowing it because there's a need not to offend sort of that class who were sort of contributing to the church financially, right? So there's a lot of, it's a difficult sort of line.
You have this like this martial elite, so this bunch of blokes who go around, killing people basically, and it seems to be like it's a way of like controlling them through, you know, romance and
very much so,
and you know, just trying to channel their their aggression, and then it's like, well, we got the tournament, you know, you can take it out there, kind of thing. it's just, so how does the tournament fit in with the concept of chivalry?
Before we jump to the tournament, I just want to continue on something that Elizabeth was saying.
Yeah.
Right, for religion, because I do think that religion is a fascinating subject that people keep omitting in studies in regards to chivalry, because it is part, it's such a big part of the social structure.
Huge part.
Here at the time. And also it's a big part of the practice of chivalry itself, right? Of knighthood. There's some amazing research by a colleague called Sarah Offenberg. Most of her essays can be found online for free. Now, excuse me, Sarah, because you will probably listen to this if I misquote this, because she told me something really interesting. Sarah has written a book about Jewish knights. Which are a rarity, because I had never considered that before she told me this. It's because being Christian and being able to take a Christian oath is part of being knighted.
Yes.
If you were of a different religion, you could not tick that box. However, there are exceptions, like both in times of war and so on and so on, which I find fascinating, that because there are exceptions, and therefore, is it actually necessary?
Is what necessary? Religious aspect.
Being Christian,
it
was seen as something mandatory.
yeah,
for something to be knighted. However, clearly there are exceptions to this. And
I'm
then...
just thinking of, like, is it St. Maurice? The
But St. Maurice, yeah, like that's a but St. Maurice was Christian.
He was Christian, okay.
And also he was Roman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's from much earlier, yeah. But it's I'm thinking more of people of different religion who practice openly other religions in a historical context and not in after the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about the constructed identity and you know how you said that, you know, that you had blokes going around killing each other,
mm-hmm.
Which is like an exaggeration, but unfortunately...
And any peasants are getting their way, basically.
But what I find interesting is that we do have examples that are well documented of rulers and nobles in the European space. Probably the most famous example of this is Charles the Bald of Burgundy, who actively tried to adhere to, famously, to all these constructed chivalric ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And he was seen as the ideal knight.
Mm-hmm.
For that reason.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he ended up dying from an axe to his face, but...
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but not from another knight, but from, you know, some rowdy Swiss in the battlefield. But that's a whole different point. But it's quite interesting to see how, essentially, a constructed fantasy of sorts that closely relates to the reality affected people in real life sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, like...
No, I mean, we didn't discuss religion beforehand when we were sort of talking about it, but it is interesting to sort of mention it there because, you know, I think it's easy, like you say, it's easy to forget. Of course, you've got like the Crusades and everything, which is all about religion.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, the religious aspect of chivalry often gets forgotten, I think.
Yeah, well, definitely, and especially when you have sort of taking it back to the romances a little bit, one of the three areas of chivalry in literature is about duty to God, and you see mm-hmm. this in Sir Galahad and Sir Percival in the Grail legends, who have such a huge, huge emphasis on this. But I suppose you could extend it to, you know, we get a lot of knights in these tales who actually aren't Christian in descent, but then come into the Round Table and all this. So, and you know, you've got accounts of Saladin in the Crusades being talked about actually quite highly at times,
yeah.
How he conducts himself, but he wouldn't be considered into these orders if you're defining chivalry as being part of this order, which is one way of defining it, but definitely not the only way.
Mm-hmm. Almost honorary.
Yes, sort of, yes.
So let's come on to tournaments now. So how did chivalry apply when it came to controlled aggression, aka tournaments?
I'll let Yasin start, because yeah.
Right, okay. Bloody hell, like I feel like we're oversimplifying on everything, but I guess you can only cover that much on in a podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you can talk for as long as you like, chaps. We're not limited, unless you.
But I suppose no, because we really would talk for hours, yes, and hours, right, and hours, Fran.
That's cool.
Yeah, don't let me nerd out on tournaments. No?
Exactly.
Right, give us 40 minutes on the tournaments, please.
Really?
Don't tell him that, because we really will. I mean, as much as I would love to do 40 minutes to an hour on the tournament, people would not want to listen to it.
Anyway, the it goes back again to what Elizabeth said, into the principle of controlling crowds, right? So
mm-hmm.
the tournaments are a complicated subject, and how they start, and it has been the subject of debate where and when tournaments start and how. It starts as military practice. It comes from chivalric, like, from horsemanship games and practice for war and time of peace and all that. I recommend David Crouch's book on the early medieval tournament, not early medieval, as in the early tournament.
Yeah.
Because he explains very, very well, in my opinion, how the melee, which was like the initial form of it, it was very, very different to the image that we have, that most of us have anyway, before reading about it, which is the jousting bit, which mm-hmm. comes in way later. Initially, the tournaments were group games, group mock combats that also had codified rules They were there for the martial elite. You participated in mock battles. You did not, you hit your opponents usually, but you did not aim to kill. You were capturing them. There are certain knights who reached the status like of what we would perceive today as rock stars. You know, they would tour around Europe. They would go to tournaments. Men and women would go on the walls, greeting them, throwing them like, you know, the equivalent of throwing clothes and brass in an 80s concert. That's actually happening. I kid you not. But there were people who clearly it was the difference between whatever was before that, which was the preparation for war. I think an integral part of the tournament, even the early on, when it's like it's still a group sport, it's its aspect as a spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's you have the martial elite that is there to be admired either by a court, which is the rest of the societal elite, or by a general public.
Mm-hmm.
And it can create a very strong visual presence, right? And then, of course, later you have the martial elite like engaging in the later forms of tournament where you have the jousting and its myriad different forms. Again, I recommend articles by Natalie Anderson, who wrote about certain forms on it and the different equipment for all of these. You have foot combat, you know, knights fighting, again, following different rule sets with swords, staff weapons. You have wrestling competitions, again, still part of the tournament. Usually people forget that wrestling is a very, very important part. Famously, but mind you that England and France nearly went to war because the Henry VIII and Francis I, who were both avid wrestlers, they had like sort of like a match, and because their egos were so enlarged, they nearly they kicked off, like Henry lost, and then they nearly started a war. But
well, it wasn't even just that they had a match, they were actually it was downtime that they started sort of going, oi, do you want to fight, sort of thing. So it wasn't even necessarily just part of the tournament, it was outside of that as well.
Men being assholes in the 16th century, essentially.
Effectively, yes.
It's literally like a fight in the car park kind of thing.
Yeah, literally.
It was in the pub, more like they were actually drinking and feasting. And then besides that, you also have like all these side competitions like hunting, archery, shooting that are also quite important. And then you rarely hear about these things. You have falconry, you have hunting, and all these like they become parts of tournaments. Tournaments become these larger than life events.
So what is it about them that makes them important? Is it just purely the entertainment? Does it represent something?
Oh my god, what a massive, massive question.
We got all the time in the world.
I'm hyperventilating. Take this.
Me too. Oh my god. I can't even breathe. It's sorry, I've got a little bit flustered. Could you repeat that question? I've had so many things come to my head.
Yeah. So, well, Elizabeth, you're raring to go. What is it about tournaments? I mean, I could go either way. So what is it about them that makes them so important in the period?
God, what? So, I mean, as Yasin, I apologise. I'm going to repeat probably a lot of what Yasin's just said. But, you know, they start this way to practice, have couch lances where lances are being held overhead. And when you bring horses into that mix, horses are not great on the battlefield. They're not going to step on dead bodies. They're going to be really skittish. It's really, as anyone who will know who rides horses, it's very, very difficult to train them. So tournaments came through from this idea through the tournée, which comes from the French word tournée, which means to turn. So you've got these horses and knights. They're trying to work together and work out, okay, when we charge and we hit the people in front of us, we can't just scatter and lose our formation. We've got to make sure we stay as a unit as we break out of this. So as Yasin mentioned, these things started across villages and swathes of countryside. But then the problem you get is you start to get spectators coming in. And it's, again, as Yasin said, it becomes about spectacle. And that
Alan V. Murray and Karen Watts have recently written an amazing book on, and Yasin's chapter on foot combat I'd highly recommend. There's a lot of great stuff in there, and it's about this idea of spectacle and pageantry for the spectators. Now, as a spectator, you can't really watch across huge swathes of countryside for things, and you'll lose a lot of these fights. And at the same time, you have this code of chivalry and this idea of individual honour and glory sort of coming to that individual attention. Miles to the right of where people are watching, and all these things are not being sort of noticed. So you start to contain the tournament and bring it in, and you bring it in, then you bring less people, and it evolves into this single combat eventually. And the point of all this as it changes is it's the form of the tournament changes as its function begins to change. So it begins as this military practice and then becomes a way for people to start watching and becomes a fun event. And then feasting comes around. Since it marks marriages, all of this sort of stuff. And directly relates to chivalry ever so quickly, you have a very specific type of tournament called the Round Table Tournament, which is actually currently what I'm writing my master's dissertation on. And you get a lot of knights at these round tables at the end of them taking the cross. So for instance, the Waltham Round Table of 12 accidentally kills Earl Mountney, I think that's how you say his name. There was debate as to whether it was an accident or not, but he ends up taking the cross to sort of make up for this. And
taking the cross, you mean like Christ took the cross, bearing a cross?
No, taking the cross more means sort of that you're going to go on to crusade and you're going at least that's my understanding of it.
Taking up the
And you get instances where you have tournaments where knights are dressed as Arthurian characters, and in character they say, "Oh yes, and I'll go and do this for King Arthur," and then the king at the end of it actually takes them up on that as the actual knights and said, "All right, go on then. You've promised this in combat. Let's go."
Oh my god. So it goes from being military practice to a spectacle to entertainment to a kind of ritual.
I mean, yeah, and then later, like, a political event and a spectacle, really. But, again, I think it's important to stress, and I cannot stress this enough, that when we talk about all of these aspects of the tournament, we're talking about processes that start from the 12th century, and they keep going on and on and on until the 17th century, right? It's not, like, one after another, nor all of these things happen simultaneously. Some do. But usually, like the aspect of the group combat, the military, where is that one? The mock combat, sort of, because then you do have group events. God damn it! Unfortunately, the only thing I can actually compare them to is things like you see at the Battle of the Nations. Oh my god, they hate me.
Believe you reference that.
which is I hate, as much as I hate it, like one of the few things that actually resemble the historical part of competition is where you did have group combat in lists even later, where you had teams initially in a form of a free-for-all, not as much as the I'll bash your head in as Battle of the Nations, but more like in it was slightly more refined, sometimes less refined. You did have massive accidents there as well.
Yeah, people would die, wouldn't they?
These are exceptions. Like, serious injuries and death are exceptions. But you did have the occasional, like, broken arm, leg, and so on. And later, when you do have the, you know, you start having jousting, you even start having, like, jousting relay of sorts, where you have group scoring. Even foot combat, where you have two teams fighting against each other over a barrier, either with swords, spears, pikes, all that. What I find fascinating, because when we're talking about jousting and the later tournaments of the 15th, 16th, and especially 17th centuries, we're already talking about a situation, and I'm doing this to give you a cue for what I know we're going to discuss next, which is that all these things happen.
Sorry, you've gone quiet there. Last word you said was happened.
The reason that these tournaments happen, can you hear me?
Yeah, do you say the reason they happen?
the reason that they happen is that these people who participate in these events try to associate and themselves to the fabled chivalric past.
Yeah,
so they're trying to convey a martial ethos and practice that was largely constructed, but is treated as something that was happening. It's just canon of the past. It
seems so what they're doing is reenactment.
Pretty much, yeah. Like I know it's an oversimplification, but yeah. So they're reenacting something they consider true. So in a sense, they're trying to elevate themselves to present to be the exemplar aspect of what they are.
Or when it's cosplay.
Oh my god! I'm just thinking now of Henry VIII cosplaying now as a Japanese schoolgirl and thank you, Fran. Jesus. But yeah, when you have kings like Henry VIII participating in tournaments wearing these clothes that are symbolic elements like the noble heart and so on, they are trying to present themselves in the ideal form of what knighthood and so on was when we saw it. And this is the beginning of what is referred to as the cult of chivalry. You have the creation of these pseudo chivalric orders, like the Order of the Garter and so on, where you have the martial elite of the time participating and existing, trying to be part of something. And then the whole idea of the cult of chivalry, besides the fact that you're trying to idealize and transmit these, again, constructed ideals, is that sense of belonging to something grander than what you are. You have the example of Henry VIII and Maximilian I, Holy Roman Emperor, right? Where they see each other as close to each other, even though they weren't. They only corresponded and they acted in the same political scene. They thought they were close to each other because they tried to transmit the same chivalric ideas of the past and rekindle that idea in the respective courts. And then you have, once you go to the 17th century, even then you have repeated case of culture of chivalry throughout Europe, Spain, Germany, England, Scotland, and so on. You have the tournament, much as what Elizabeth said earlier, as the vehicle used to create the chivalric constructed identity of the elite.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're back, Elizabeth. So, Elizabeth, you wanted to say something on this?
Yes, yeah. So I repeat some of what Yasin said because, as Franz mentioned, I sort of disappeared there for a second. Yes, it's interesting talking about these orders and things because you have there's sort of a cult of interest around sort of Arthurian literature and chivalry at this time with Edward I and Edward III. I mean, you have Edward I even taking I think it's Gallen's coronet out of Wales and they translate what they assume to be King Arthur's body. So there is this sort of attempt to connect themselves to King Arthur. You even get this with the Tudors trying to tie their lineage back to Arthur. And as Yasin mentioned, you do have the Order of the Garter, which was established by Edward III in 1348 and is still in existence today. We still have Garter Knights around. And it echoes the Spanish. They had a military order in Spain by Alfonso XI, which was the Order of the Band, which came in about 10, 15 years before that. But what's interesting is Edward III actually attempted to create an order before the Order of the Garter, which is missed over quite a lot when we talk about these orders. And he tried to come up with the Order of the Round Table about 4 years earlier at a round table he held at Windsor Castle. And it didn't really pick up because he had all these really, really high up lofty ideas and it just sort of didn't come to fruition. They were too ambitious sort of to carry out. But it was interesting that he attempted again 4 years later. And for some reason, it seems to have stuck. So there was definitely an appetite to present oneself as being part of this sort of fantastical chivalric order.
And something to address on this, which I assume that is something that might be of interest to our listeners is, you know, because we talked about the beginning of chivalry, right? Mm-hmm. And once we reach that point that Elizabeth discusses, we're talking about, you know, the end of chivalry, you know, mm-hmm. once, once having these orders in the 16th century, especially, we're talking about cults that mm-hmm. they're trying to revive things of the past, because the necessity for chivalry has fizzled, right? You know, mm-hmm. the concept of war has changed. And the martial elite does not play the same role in the war actively as he was before, and you know, like, and that changes throughout Europe, and of course that has to reshape how the ideals of that elite is portrayed. I think the best example to see how this has deteriorated is that besides the romances, you know, like from the Chanson de Guest early on, and then Crétin de Troyes and so on and so on. In the 17th century, suddenly you have Don Quixote, which is a parody of chivalry. It's down to its core. It's a comedy, a burlesque, a reversal,
like a satire.
Here's a satire. All the things that we perceive today as being again, how the hell do you pronounce that? Quixotic. You have a main character who is constantly who's stuck in these anachronistic culty. Because Don Quixote, he's following a cult of chivalry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason for him to behave as he is. And then you have his squire, Sancho Panza, who is the voice of reason in a modern society where this is different. And Panza is completely aware that his master, you know, is acting weird for his time, but he goes with it because, you know, like he's of the elite, he's not. I do find it fascinating. And then you have like these revivals of chivalry keep happening from the 17th century all the way to the 19th century over and over. You do have various cases of that.
Mm-hmm. And arguably even now, but we'll come on to that in a minute. So, you know, these sort of revivals, I mean, even reviving it and harking back to a romanticized past seems to be part and parcel for chivalry in itself. It's mm-hmm. a sort of perpetual cycle, it seems to be. So let's talk about the revival of the chivalric revival of the 19th century. There's a lot of artwork that came out around that time, wasn't there?
Yes, yeah.
Let's start off with you, Elizabeth.
Let's not, because I actually know very little about this. All I know really is about like Gautier's code that he writes about chivalry, but that's sort of as far as my knowledge of this goes, which I'm interested to see what Yasin has to say about it.
Yasin, go for it.
Yeah, I don't want to dig into it too much, but there's a lot of, like, in the 18th and 19th century, of course, you have all these, even in Britain, you have all these modern tournaments that are modern revivals, where people see under a romantic spectrum all these past ideas. I mean, romanticizing the past is not something new in the 20th century, not in the 20th century. People have always been romanticizing the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that chivalry is in its own nature something predominantly, I want to say, positive, kinda. And it encapsulates so many ideas that fit different European societies, and especially their elites, which is its key, right? So usually chivalry revivals happen from the elite until the 19th century. That it keeps being rekindled as an idea. You have people who dress up in armor, cosplaying, as Fran aptly said earlier. I do not know why I'm wrong, but now I'm going to stick with it. And you do have all these different orders. You even have like literature. Like, I think as a kid, one of my favorite books was Ivanhoe, right? By Walter Scott. And now probably my supervisor would kill me, but I don't remember exactly when it was written. I think it's like late
1819.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. but it's I remember when I was reading it as a kid, right? I thought that was a historic fact, right?
Yeah.
You know, Ivanhoe was a knight, and I grew up and Ivanhoe was not real. No.
But, do you know, I had the opposite reaction when I found out Ulrich von Liechtenstein was a real person from watching The Knight's Tale, and then look back and go, oh my god, he's real. So I went the opposite way.
I think people have romanticized that in the 19th century in a way that it's very different to what I assume you're going to discuss afterwards, the 20th century. It's seen more as chivalry was used as a vehicle for artistic endeavors. You have music, visual arts that were influenced by the iconography sorts of chivalry. I guess you have literature, like much like Scott. Again, sorry, like thinking of the top of my head right now, I cannot recall more. But you have all these different examples, and you have. I find interesting that chivalry has been used as a vehicle to propaganda past the 17th century, like in the 18th and the 19th century, in different peripheries in Europe and even in the newfound United States. Mm-hmm.
You get that, don't you, in a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court?
Yes, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Which is a very, very interesting book that sort of satirizes all these romantic ideals, and it sort of was considered to be sort of a parallel to the First World War and everything, and it's very interesting. And I agree with a lot of what Yasin's saying about how everyone's been looking back towards the past since forever, really. I think I'm going to take it in quite a different direction. I was going to talk about the Eglinton tournament, unless you want to touch on that.
Talk about the tournament, because I wanted to say something that is a bit more grim.
Grim?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to start off happy, listeners, and we're going to talk about the Eglinton tournament, which happened in 1839, which was a reenactment of medieval jousts. It was in somewhere in Scotland, Ayrshire, I think. It was in Ayrshire, and it's really interesting for me to see what was translated through sort of history and what the main qualities of the medieval joust these people took. Because I remember when I was very first getting into tournament studies and I saw these illustrations of this tournament, I thought it was sort of a little bit of an artistic interpretation of the medieval tournament, but it was a later reenactment. And it's the pageantry of this, it was such a huge, huge spectacle. The amount of money that went on to into the trophy, which again, we don't really have, trophies weren't really a thing with tournaments, unless there's a source that I'm unaware of. You do get prizes on occasion, but not trophies. So you get this sort of translation of the medieval joust into sort of sporting terms. Lots of colour. They had a parade and everything. So it's interesting because on the one hand, they completely get it wrong. On the other hand, they actually get it quite right in that they have lots of pageantry and festivity surrounding it. So it's a very interesting event.
I wonder if back then there was also the people who saw these people wearing armor and participating in this, and they were like, you know, fucking reenactors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they probably were. <'cause it's... laughs> Yeah, well, they were. They get a lot. They got a lot of ridicule from the Whigs, because it was such a non-satirical presentation of romanticism. You know, we're so used to sort of these sort of tongue-in-cheek things now, and sort of taking the mick a little bit. And even with modern films, there is that. If you're really leaning into it, it is completely fantastical. If it's a historical thing, you tend to go for the more gritty, you know, it's like Monty Python, How Do You Know He's the King? Well, he's not covered in a rude word like the rest of us. You know.
We've said bad words already.
So okay, great. He's not covered in shit like the rest of us. Yeah, so it's this kind of, it was on the one, it's actually more realistic because you have all these colours and everything and everyone's not covered in shit. But on the other hand, they completely get it wrong as well. It's a very interesting, it's very earnest endeavour at reenactment, I think.
I wonder, like, our like I'm sorry, previous...
I hadn't realised that we were a PG podcast, sorry.
No, we're not.
I'm we're just not. Trying to be... You don't know. We could have little ears listening. You don't know.
I'm just thinking, like, I've seen in photos pictures of what's his name, the guy who classified all the sword types.
Dog shirt.
Oakshot.
You are Oakshot.
These guys and people like Edgerton Castle and Hutton.
Yeah,
they're like our sort of like the last incarnation of HEMA, I guess, prior to like the early 2000s, late 90s. So, and they were all massive nerds who dressed up as knights and, you know, had huge pageants and things. Right. So that's like the last, I guess, tail end of that revival.
It's quite interesting because, again, like those are people that you said, it's interesting because they cover like a very wide period, like, but it's spot on. You start from Hutton and you have Castle, and then you have like Bashford Dean in the States, who was the first curator of the Anselmian collection at the Met. And then you have Oakshot, of course, Oakshot is much later, but yeah, it's they all come from the same vein, sort of. They are amateurs who nerd out and effectively they leave something back that even affects research. My favorite, like, I've read a quote from Bashford Dean, right? So that was the curator. He was a curator of the Anselm collection at the Met, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He had a personal collection of arms and armor, and that became the Met arms and armor collection later. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he died really young. People usually know him from these amazing sketches that he featured in his books that look like the genealogical trees of arms and armor. You must have one of them somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I know the ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he was like, he's a lovely fella, like, apparently. Like, everybody loved him. And when somebody would visit his place, he would hand out, yeah, you like the sword? Have the sword. You like the gauntlets? Have these gauntlets, and so on. He had a massive collection. But I remember there's a beautiful letter where he complains to one of his friends, where they all dress in armor. Like, and that's original harnesses that they're using.
Yeah.
They dress in these, and they make fun of somebody else who's wearing, like, who has the financial means to have a good armor, but he has made like a crappy one. And you know, like, it just reminds me, like the modern criticism of petty criticism, you know, like, oh, what a casual, you know, like,
yeah, all gear, no idea.
Yeah,
exactly.
You called.
But yeah, it's quite interesting, like, overall, like, in the positive line of thinking with all these revivals is I think it's the idea of the principle of how appealing the idea of chivalry is throughout, and then as I said before, at its core, it's appealing, it's romantic, and there's enough of literary works either from, you know, the Middle Ages, early modern period, and even recently that have further romanticized it to make it into something appealing from when we're young until we're older, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, but I also think that we need to tread very lightly when we deal with such ideas, because it is a complicated subject. And again, we're only scratching the very tip of the iceberg of it in this you know, short podcast. But what I want to say earlier about, you know, the negative thing when we're talking about 18th and 19th century is that you have, besides these revivals in the positive aspects of the martial elite, you also have a revival in the use of chivalry as the vehicle for the justification of sort of like, what's the way to describe it, of not justifying, but
rationalizing
for war against an enemy of a different religion, right? So, so when you have the big fights of the 18th century against the Ottoman Empire, there's a lot of resurgence of the use of iconography as well as lexicology of chivalry, of different like buzzwords that come from the Middle Ages, or at least these concepts, when fighting against the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, with at the forefront having analogies with the Crusades, which are also a hugely problematic subject, but maybe the subject of another podcast that we should not do. But yeah, so you do already have this use of chivalry for other means other than its romanticized version, for a polemic, pretty much against a collective, an enemy, and in this case, it is a religious enemy.
So this is like, you know, the closer we get to our own time with the concept of chivalry, the more icky it gets. Because we've always romanticized the past, and chivalry is kind of like about perpetuating that cycle.
But it's sort of always been a bit icky, I think.
Yeah.
At its core, it is a bit icky. That's the thing.
And I think that's why we struggle when people are earnestly reproducing it, because you have to have a lot of context around the side of it going, clearly has its problems. I am very much aware of that. This is, you know, so I think, you know, for example, the Eglinton tournament, they were called just utterly tone deaf by a lot of their critics, because obviously at the time you've got a lot of poverty going on and social problems. And what's interesting is a lot of people who attended then helped sort of found the Tory party, who obviously have a lot of interest in looking towards the past and tradition and all of that. So there's a lot of debate going on there. And it's all about, I suppose, how you approach the topic. And obviously, as long as you know that it's an idealized version, it was always idealized, all of this, you've got to be quite careful.
I agree, and it's an interesting notion. Yeah, like I often get annoyed, I know you're as well, Fran, with the use of you know, the vocabulary and how such concepts as chivalry are thrown out of context willy-nilly today. But yeah, like I think what Elizabeth is raising is quite important, that it was always used as such. I simply think that now it's closer to us, so probably the reaction that we have today to, you know, all the ridiculous people that are trying to introduce like new chivalric orders and all that bullshit, it's simply because we are in close proximity to it, probably. Yeah. For like, as Elizabeth said, people were reacting to this in the 19th century, and for all we know, you know, all the way back to the 17th century. Again, look at Don Quixote. You still have people who criticize this.
And if I may take it back even further, you have. I'm going back to round table tournaments again. Obviously, sorry guys, it's 2 months till my dissertation. I'm thinking about at the moment. But you have all these tournaments, and they are a lot of pageantry, a lot of sort of chivalric imagery, and they are taking place at the sites where people have actually, colonized certain places and taken over politically. They then hold these tournaments displaying the knights of the sort of the side that won, as it were. So it's always been a very icky concept, and it's not a very, even though it's found in a lot of fellowship and honor and loyalty, there's a lot of horrible things that come with that in order to establish that order. Like, for example, the reason I bring it up is because when these orders were founded, we talk about the cult of chivalry now. The cult of chivalry then was also icky and founded upon a lot of problematic sort of nationalistic ideals.
So the cult of chivalry now, like, as we say, it can get super icky. And
the technical term, yes.
Yeah, veering. I mean, we're talking like white nationalism, you know, romanticized, weaponized by the far right, as Hitler did as part of his propaganda machine.
Yes, you've got a portrait of him dressed in full plate armor.
But mind you, now that's I think propaganda is like one of the things that I really care about, and I find it fascinating, especially in military context. When you look, if you're going to take like the Third Reich, for example, in Germany, 1939, in 1940, there's a lot of pamphlets that portray German soldiers as knights, besides that famous poster with Hitler, there's a lot of posters that makes allusions to the Teutonic Order. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of cultural production at the time in Central Europe towards that. But besides, again, it's always an idealization of the past. There's a lot of things towards the Middle Ages, and of course the other part of it is always the classics. Mm-hmm. It's always them too. I think it's quite interesting. When we decided to do this podcast, I was considering, how is the modern, the 21st century cult of chivalry problematic? And I remember that my first encounter to something like this, now, back when I was maybe like 13 years old.
So a long time ago.
Were you even born then?
No, I wasn't.
Oh God! No, you weren't. You weren't.
I wasn't.
Go on, Grandpa. Tell us your story.
Anyway, thank you. I'm old enough. Forget now. No.
She's snorting her tea.
I remember. I had access to my mother's computer and browsing the internet. And I loved knights, and I looked at pictures I discovered the few images that were online of knights and all that. I was printing on a crappy printer posters, and I discovered, I remember back then, something like a pseudo-chivalric order that I cannot recall how it was. Maybe it was something similar to what, it reminds me something between what Christian Tobler is a member of, or early days Arma, or simply like a pseudo-chivalric thing. And I remember thinking, like, this is so cool, because when you think of it from a raw perspective of, a young teenage boy, it's a romanticized version of what you know from books. You become a member, and then you get all these titles associated with chivalry. You start as a squire, you become a knight, blah, blah, all that bullshit that you find, unfortunately, in the process of, that have been weaponized, sort of like in other contexts of other cults. Of course, there are many of these around, and some are complete harmless, where you can go and nerd out.
Yeah.
And others are used, like, I think the minority is unfortunately used as a vehicle to very different agendas. And I think it has become a vehicle for white nationalism, partially because of these, because of the illusion of the heroic idealized past, which is always,
always present.
Yeah. And the other one is because you have the aforementioned strong element of religion, a very strong element of whiteness, which is also problematic, among other things. I'm pretty sure that there has been scholarly work on this done, but unfortunately, we still live in the period where we face these weird groups on a day-to-day basis.
Well, if I may, just on that note, that I know there's been in 2019, the Studies of Medievalism journal printed a very good series on medievalism and discrimination, and it tackles a lot of anti-Semitism, racial hatred and all this, and sort of the cult of medievalism. So I would highly recommend checking that out.
What I was going to say was, like, you've got obviously the sort of appropriation of chivalric, ideals by the far right and so forth, but on a much more insidious way, chivalry gets weaponized in an everyday manner, I find, in a kind of as a vehicle for misogyny. The chivalry's dead, kind of thing, people will often say, or you hold a door
people open, have always been saying
you're
that
accused of being sexist and things like that.
People have said chivalry's dead since chivalry was ever a thing. People have been complaining about it forever.
Yeah, probably like the earliest thing that was said about chivalry was, like, it died
it died.
It was cool, and it was, you know, when it
but happened. They keep flogging this horse.
Yeah, it's there's the Elizabeth, help me. When did Petrarch write things?
Oh, 12. I want to say late 12, early 1300s. No, it was early 1300s.
Yeah. I don't really remember. Like, there's like the Petrarch, who is like one of the great thinkers of the High Middle Ages, Late Middle Ages. He criticized chivalry about being useless, about the knights being grunts. And we're talking about a period where, you know, like that would have been like the peak of chivalry.
Yeah.
He criticized it like from a social point of view. I don't know, like I think that there's a lot of iffy things, and I think because of its nature, in a racist context, in a sexist context, I think all of these things stem from using certain terms, namely chivalry, but as well as other things, as you know, the knightly codes, all that shebang, without knowing what they were. Like as Fran knows, I do have like an interest in the vocabulary of the far right from a scholarly perspective. And last year at the IMC, I had like some really interesting conversations with people who study this, especially Crusades and the far right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's interesting because all these arguments and the use of the term of chivalry stem from the idea that all these were a thing. You know, mm-hmm. like these things existed in a very solid, recognizable, you know, monolithic, unchangeable way at some point that simply was lost, you know.
Yeah. It's I think that's a very interesting point. And I think that when you find people, you know, you mentioned that, you know, Petrarch was criticizing chivalry at technically the height of chivalry. I think what's interesting is when you find, you know, historical sources, literary sources discussing, oh, this is the best way to be a knight. It's probably because people are not being the best knights. You tend not to write about things that are accepted. You tend to write about things that are outside the normal, things that could be better or toned down a bit. You don't really write about this is how things are while it's happening. And I think, jumping on your point about, you know, how chivalry then ties into a lot of misogyny, again, in this Studies in Medievalism in 2019, Lauren Mayer writes an excellent article about this. And she jumps on David Matthews' point about there being two main threads of medievalism, Gothic and grotesque versus a more sexual, romantic one. And she calls them benevolent and hostile sexism. So benevolent being that sort of, you know, carrying heavy things, opening the door for women, jumping to their defence. Hostile being, you know, verbal, physical assaults. Yes, exactly. And the hostile side being sort of the assaults. And it's interesting, you can take this all the way back to Gawain in, you know, again, I'm referencing Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, where he is this benevolent but slightly sexist, you know, looking up, you know, all this, let me do this for you, let me do this, let me do this. When actually the woman in the text can actually handle herself pretty well.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, it's very interesting because after he ends up failing this thing, spoiler alert, everyone. He then goes on this massive diatribe against women. It's really interesting. And yet he's meant to be this nice and attaining all these great things, and he keeps on falling short because of things like this. But it's very interesting, women's role in this and the idea that chivalry is a performance for women is part of that. So you definitely get a lot of that back to chivalry for sure.
If our listeners are interested in this, what I also recommend, there's a great book by Sophie Howard, which is, I don't know the precise title, it's something like, it's about women in French romances, mm-hmm. but it tackles a lot of these principles and how in its context chivalry was affected by its social norms. But I think that if you transfer something so anachronistic to today, besides being de facto problematic,
mm-hmm.
I think that the underlining the underlying agenda, consciously on or you know, unconsciously, subconsciously, it's going to cause problems, and it's going to be at best problematic, because if it's done deliberately, then it becomes malicious.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe this time, do we just let chivalry die?
Chivalry will never die, because even when people haven't been trying to perpetuate it, it keeps on bouncing back, because it speaks to a way that we behave ourselves in society. It's just a term we happen to use. You know, it started off with, one of the ways it started was, again, this shift in battle from openly killing people to starting to take prisoners, capture, look after prisoners. So it's very much a code based in just being a nice person, really, except, you know, when you get to the medieval and romance, it has very specific terms, like, you know, and very specific goals. But it all sort of, and I'm hugely oversimplifying, because we're not here for a 4 or 5 hour lecture on the nuances of it all, but it does boil down to just handling yourself well socially, looking after people, being loyal to people, being kind and all that. And I think it's interesting that we apply it to knights, and I think there's a reason we apply it to knights, who are people who exert a lot of physical, financial, all of this kind of power. It's a good way to sort of keep that all in check and give them an opportunity to show off at the same time.
Let them get their aggression out by looking pretty.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's yeah, I think it's a bit unfair to say that we need to let chivalry die, because A, I think it's long dead. But yeah, you know, but we forgot to bury it, so
yeah. We left the body out.
Whoops, yeah. I think besides the problems that it creates, unfortunately, often, and you know, and causes us fits of rage. It has also, it is also the source of, besides scholarly study, like, it's the source still of great cultural artistic production. And I'm talking about anything from fantasy concept art, and the, you know, like, you can go to RPG games, all these like computer games and all that. They do root themselves in a way, in a romanticized way, but I want to say that is mostly innocent. Again, appealing to all these things that Elizabeth said, I think what we need to be is vigilant in weeding out all these problematic aspects that were and remain problematic. We need to keep reminding ourselves, as well as the public, that this is an imaginary context. Mm-hmm. It was largely an imaginary context and remains such.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trying to, I think the only thing that is condemnable is trying to, if you're trying to accept such artificial aspects of the past as, you know, canon and reality, and you try to apply them today, whatever might be from the past that you try to apply to today, it's going to be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And in the context, if you want to, of, you know, European martial arts, which is one of our common denominators of the three of us, to me, like, because I have unfortunately heard of many practitioners the idea that, you know, like we need to be chivalrous because we're practicing practices of knights and all that bullshit. And then I cannot describe my cringe when I hear anything like this. My butter like gets like stuck up, and I want to leave the room every time I listen to something like this.
And he frequently does.
Yes.
Elizabeth, you're worried about swearing, and Yasin's describing what his butt hair does when he hears.
Children, I am so sorry if you are listening, exactly, little ears.
It's the only way to describe how much I cringe, right?
No, there are other ways, Yasin. There are other ways.
But I think that all this belongs into the wider context, you know, when you of what is often described as bullshido, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like trying to apply an ethical context and code of conduct of the past in modern practices.
Mm-hmm.
Why the hell would you do this? Like, it's like, I understand treating martial arts with seriousness, like, because, you know, for some it's a hobby, for others I can understand being a method of meditation and an integral part of their lives and something more serious. However, saying that you are obliged to channel the fictionalized elements of somebody's, you know, like past. I'm getting so angry at this. I cannot even word it right now.
Okay, I'm gonna take over then. In that case, yeah,
like I'm going banging my head in the wall.
Yeah. Okay. I've go breathe for a second. I think it's important to note that tournaments now and medieval weaponry and all this is very much taking place in a sphere about sports and academic interest. Mm. We cannot apply things that would have applied to a society in which these things are being trained in order to really hurt people. Yeah. That was the original point of all this. And chivalry comes in to temper that because there is this trend within society and this, and partially because I know people are going to go, no, it's actually because of this. Look, there are many reasons chivalry came through, but one of them is it happens to be a great way to control that as well. So to apply it now to, it's sort of trying to fix a problem that isn't there. It's yes. Like saying we're bringing in chivalry. It's like, no, let's all just be nice people, and we're doing this for sport and for academic interest. There's no need to bring in these tenets because that the foundation on which they were founded simply doesn't exist, and now does not even apply. These things were only pursued as sort of, to my mind, sort of more theatrical concepts, and that's how they should remain. So when we get reenactment, for instance. Reenactment very much has its place in educating people about history, showing people, helping them visualize how these things took place, but it does not have a place in serious sports side of it, actually competing. That should not come into it at all, in my opinion. And as I say, it is a huge simplification. That point alone could be debated for hours and hours, but we unfortunately don't have hours and hours.
Just to sort of throw in about, you know, we've been through the icky sticky bum hair side of things, the cringe, the nice clean innocent side of that coin is that none of us would have picked up a stick in the woods as a kid and pretended it was a sword, and then later as adults taken up sword fighting as our sort of passion if it weren't for chivalry, surely.
Sorry, I'm gonna let Elizabeth take this one as well, if you want to address it, because I'm still like squeezing my stress ball here.
Stressful too.
Oh my god, me too.
What's yours? I've got a pug head.
I've got a little fidget spinner because I get so stressed about talking about. I get so pent up that I was like, I know I need something to chill out.
I've got a new pig.
Oh, I just fidget, so I've had to make sure I've got a stress toy, a fidget toy that doesn't make any clicky sounds. So.
Same here. Anyway, sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, the sort of innocent side of it, like what you know, we. You know, the romantic without the icky, you know, as children, we're drawn to sword fighting because of chivalry.
Yeah. And I think even it's, even it's, if you want, in an innocent way, even the ideological side of as something positive and maintaining around for fictional purposes, I think can always be beneficial. However, I have problems with the vocabulary used. Again, as you said earlier, that perpetuates especially sexist stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if all these things are addressed, right? I'm not talking like to address these as when a child plays with a stick, right? But if you address this to an adult, explaining this, I think. It's something lovely, right? Again, as you said, like how many of us would have actually ended up doing martial arts if we didn't have these references from films, if we hadn't seen Kevin Costner butchering Robin Hood, and all
but
that.
Even Star Wars is based in chivalry.
Yeah. Like space knights and
space knights and wizards.
Yeah, like all that and. Again, like even the modern cultural production, like the films, like we live in the golden age of gaming right now, right? We have, I think it's in an interesting fact is I think either in 2019 to 2020, in the United States and Europe, it's the first time in history where when they try to do a sociological mapping of gamers. It's the first time that non-male gamers are the majority.
Mm-hmm. Well,
So the context of the people consuming that culture production changes. Still, everybody can enjoy it, right? Everybody enjoys like a good story. Even now, when somebody reads Gawain and the Green Knight, it's still a great tale. I'm really hoping that the upcoming film is good. Trailer looks great.
Yeah, I was going to say that's coming out soon, isn't it?
Yeah. I do think chivalry has a place. It can be beneficial, but it needs to be addressed with caution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you sort of hit the nail on the head there. It's for children. It's fantasy. It's fiction, yeah. And it's something to enjoy in a fictional sense. It doesn't have a place with adults, with weapons.
Way.
It is in an indulgent way because, you know, this sport. I know we sort of scoff and go, it's fine, but it's, you know, we've all sustained injuries doing this sport and, you know, it is safe, but it can get quite dangerous. And if you bring in those very emotionally charged fictional elements, that can be quite problematic. So it is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful concept in literature, in imagination, television, film, for children especially, and for those who are not interested in history to get them interested. It's so important, but it doesn't have a place in real life and never really did.
I wanted to remind something that Fran wanted us to discuss, because you mentioned you want to discuss like chivalry and knights in Game of Thrones, right?
I just wanted to sort of touch on that. I mean, I think you mentioned it earlier, Yasin, like, and I remember seeing this recently, there are no, right, in modern film, just to sort of get away from it for a second, I was going to talk about Game of Thrones, but like in modern film, even in Disney, it's always got some kind of irony in it. There's always a little bit of self-reflection. There's always a little bit of self-awareness. You know, it has to be grim, dark. It has to be gritty. Or, you know, like even in Pixar movies, there has to be a bit of fourth wall breaking, that kind of thing. But the only exception to this in sort of modern, in terms of modern cult classics, is The Lord of the Rings. Which is just completely genuine in its, you know, its passion about, you know, the story and everything. It's, there is no, you know, they're on a quest and they've got to do this, they've got to fulfill this task, but there's no kind of irony in it at all.
I assume you're referring to, again, like media and especially films from, and cities from after the 2000s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's loads of examples of the opposite in the 80s.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that's why we laugh at those movies, because they're cheesy.
Yeah. Like, I think that the idea of the gritty thing is something very recent, that it pre-existed and predated the Game of Thrones series. And again, there are books who did that. In my humble opinion, I used to be like a huge fan of Game of Thrones. I think now, probably because of the overexposure, I'm bored of it as hell. I think they were...
You liked it before it was cool.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a bloody like literary hipster, but I do appreciate it. I'm just a bit tired of it's. I think it was the series, not the book. It was a series that popularized the grim dark fantasy more than anything, sort of now, and now it has to be sprinkled in everything.
Yeah, it's ubiquitous.
Yeah, and I think you didn't have examples in literature even before that, like with Michael Moorcock, just to name like an author, even with, not to that extent with Robert Jordan, even before George R. R. Martin. But Martin's knights now, Martin's perception of chivalry, which is again like it's a criticism on those, you know, he makes violent caricatures of knighthood. I do not think that they're original to him at all. Like what he does has been done before. But when you pour several million in an HBO series, you make that popular. I think that it does very well that criticism, you know, like in the popular perception. But again, the reason that these characters work, you know, the reason that Gregor Clegane, the Mountain, the reason that the Hounds and all these work so well, even Brienne of Tarth, who is like the positive counterpart, the odd counterpart for them, I think they work so well because the public consuming that media has a very specific idea of chivalry in the heads as the chivalry is. So I think it plays really well on that.
I think it's difficult though because they, sorry to interrupt that. It's difficult because on the one hand, you know, Martin does provide a critique and it is obviously heightened because it's fantasy and it's all that. But the critique goes so far the wrong way. It makes me so angry. Yeah. It's this idea that everyone, you know, oh, everyone's suffering and, oh, women are being, you know, assaulted all the time and children are murdered and all that's just, that's how, you know, it's a more realistic, gritty view. No, it's not. It's utter rubbish. No, it's fine as a fantasy. But what becomes a problem, though, just ever so quickly, what becomes a problem is a lot of people I have met who got into fantasy, which is a very legitimate way to get into it, carry these ideas with them. They go, well, I know it's a fantasy, but obviously that was very much happening. No, no, it wasn't. Sorry, go on. Yes.
No. I had on the comment precisely on that. Like, I have people who say, I like this because it's realistic. And you have this...
It's fantasy.
This new version of the perception of the Middle Ages as a grim, dark society and all that, which is absolute bullshit. Like, you know, like you have the idea that you know, women, when like if you follow Martin, as Elizabeth said, you have the idea that women were assaulted on a daily basis in the street, that people could kill anyone on a whim because they were nobles, which is trash. Like in most societies, regardless of time, especially in the late Middle Ages and later, but frankly, even way before that, from the early Middle Ages, you had very, very closely codified canon law, you know, laws that would penalize such behavior. The most famous example of how this, and I was discussing this with my partner, I don't remember what film we're watching. There's famously in many parts in six different periods of the Middle Ages, and in certain periods even of Imperial Rome, for soldiers, for example, to rape and pillage while on duty, it was punishable by death.
It was. Ooh. It's that never means... and has never been okay ever in history. Never, yeah. There is no society in which that has ever been okay. And it's worth bearing in mind: 2% of human history is recorded. 2%. You know, it goes back so far, and the idea that we're only just starting to be, you know, civilized, codified people is absolute rubbish. Sorry. Anyway, this is what gets me angry.
And for our HEMA listeners as well, right? Because I've had this discussion in an academic context before. When you have the representations of violence, it's because violence was sexy to represent at any point in human history, like in art. It's different, you know, when you see the blood splattering in the fine books of Hans Stallhofer, it's because it's, you know, like people then liked exactly the same thing. You know, we watch nowadays Alien or... I do not know which number of Fast and the Furious with exploding heads and all that bullshit.
It's entertainment.
It's entertainment, exactly. And possibly, you know, Hans Stallhofer was probably a version of George R. R. Martin at the time. Where
Grimdark.
You have in Fury's manuscript, you've got him literally ripping arms off people and then just holding them there. Like, that didn't happen. It's all very much a fantastical literary. Yeah, exactly.
In the main bit, having a discussion between, you know, Talhofer and all that, and I hear different HEMA is saying that, you know, this is how you used to fight, kill. Bullshit! Like, killing was not okay. The reason that several writers keep going on about taking the fingers and the arms, and most techniques are there to incapacitate, it's because killing is not okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the rapier manuals, sorry, fight books, when you does a, like for Gigante, for example, when he gives you a technique, it's like he'll give you three options. You can disarm, you can threaten, or you can wound. and mm-hmm. that's wound rather than kill. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, it's about de-escalation. Mm. And it's almost like, you know, before we had a police force, everyone was just going around assaulting and killing one another. No, we were self-policing before then.
I mean, frankly, I do not know that when would have been a time without police. Like, I do not know when would have been. Like, there's always some form of enforcing rules. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, like, I had this discussion before. Like, it is one of the mantras that I do hear is the fact that police. I get the sentiment because, you know, the police has done awful things, and of course, it's the enforcing arm of administration. Mm. However, it has always been there, and it is
in either, some form.
Yeah, it is either, until we you know, replace it with something better, or the society evolves to something better, you cannot really replace that. Unfortunately, I think it's tricky. I'm really hoping in regards to Game of Thrones. I'm really hoping that. You know, that we're going to keep having excellent media in the next few years.
Yeah.
They're going to inspire future swords players, future nerds, scholars. I love The Witcher. Like, I love that series. I love the books. I love the game. Like,
oh, I hate the books, but I love the game and love the TV series. The books are absolute trash. I'm sorry, but they're awful.
They are trash. Yeah, I guess.
No, they are trash. Seriously, if anyone's ever read, like, whoever was gasping with Fran, was it you gasping?
I haven't read them, but no, you know, I don't think they are upset.
The way the women are presented, it's like it's not even funny how bad it is.
Yeah. It's. I think there's a lot of things, but I am genuinely hoping for sort of a revival of a tone similar, you know, to Willow. You know. I want to see something more like.
But that was just Lord of the Rings with a baby instead of a ring.
Yeah. It's Willow is the unlicensed Lord of the Rings. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, George Lucas doesn't get the rights to Flash Gordon. He makes Star Wars. He doesn't get the rights to Lord of the Rings. He makes Willow.
Yeah.
You know.
It's very clever.
But I would love to see more of these things, and I think they can be inspiring. But, like, I think that both the grim dark as well as, but particularly the more positive thing can be inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. So we've ended on a positive. We've gone through all the rage and the cringe.
Yeah.
And we've ended on a high. So thank you both very much for
thank you so much
about chivalry with me and enlightening us all. It's been lovely to have you on, and I hope to hang out with you again next month.
Oh yes, please, that'd be amazing.
Okay. Yeah. Take next care season. Both next-
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword. Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen.